Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News, and it's time for the Climate Cast. It's our weekly discussion of the science of climate change. Today, why the hope, at least for now, for clean coal is fading. We have a guest who's going to join us who's been writing about this plant in Mississippi. But first, NPR meteorologist Paul Huttner joins me. Hi, Paul. Good to have you here.
Good to be here, as always, Carrie.
Paul, there are some that say that clean coal is simply impossible because we really haven't worked out the carbon capture technology. I have to say, after reading our guest's article, it's further along than I thought it was.
Yeah, and that's the sort of the big picture question here is as we go through the near term, what's the right energy balance as we sort of transition into a cleaner energy economy of coal, of clean coal? Is clean coal sort of an oxymoron? And, you know, what does a climate-friendly, smart, renewable energy grid look like? I think those are the big picture questions and how that best plays out for the atmosphere. Of course, part of that is science and part of it is policy.
We know that the use of coal, in, as you've just mentioned, in the United States is power usage is diminishing, mm-hmm. right? Even though it is, I know more plants are coming online in China, even though they're trying to lessen their use of coal.
Yes.
But there's been a lot of awareness about trying to move away from coal.
There is, and part of it, you know, is science-driven and policy-driven. Part of it is cost-driven, and I think our guests can elaborate on that. But the cost of solar is getting closer to coal as a viable alternative. So, you know, that's when the economics become a whole lot more interesting.
Let me bring in our guest. Ian Urbina is a reporter for the New York Times, and his story about a clean coal project in Mississippi ran in the New York Times, and he's with us today from, is it New York, Ian? Welcome.
I'm in D.C., actually.
Okay, welcome. Good to have you here. Tell us why this Kemper plant in Mississippi was something that was quite important to the Obama administration's overall climate plan. That was pretty unexpected to me.
Yes, there's an interesting story. You know, really every president since Reagan has had his pet project when it comes to the clean coal ambition, which is, you know, the simple notion that we can still burn coal, but without such an environmental impact, and we can pull out the bad stuff, you know, in the emissions and still get electricity from the coal. And virtually all those projects have not come to fruition, often after millions in subsidies. And this Kemper project, this plant in Mississippi, has been the Obama administration's particular most hopeful poster child. You know, this was going to be the one that hopefully would prove that this can work, and you can build this kind of plant and produce electricity with 65% less carbon emissions. And as was said before, you know, a lot of these stories are partly science, partly politics, and really partly economics. The science now works. You know, carbon capture has been proven, but the challenge is figuring out whether you can scale it up and scale it up in a way that is cost efficient, especially as was said before, as the price of renewables comes down and the price of natural gas falls through the floor.
You quote a whistleblower in the story who says it has nothing to do with the design. It has nothing to do with the technology, which says, as you've noted, that the carbon capture technology works. He says it has to do with poor project management. What went wrong at this specific plant that really calls into questions some of what we're talking about today?
So I would asterisk that quote from him. In my own opinion, it does have a little bit to do with the design in that, you know, when you try to jump from a model up to a plant this large, it is a big challenge. And some of the folks I talked to about this plant said that, you know, one of their fatal errors was they made too big a jump. And, you know, the bigger you go, the harder the design is. And that still hasn't been worked out. But like you say, the big issue is mismanagement. There are allegations of more than mismanagement, actual fraud in this project. And it boils down to two basic categories. One, the allegations are, one, the the backers of this project, the company Southern, the parent company, and the utility Mississippi Power, overstated the budget, you know, how cheaply they could do it. They knew full well it would cost, this is the allegation, far more than they initially said, and the timetable. They claimed they could do it much faster. And so now it's $4 billion over budget and 2 years past deadline, still not online yet.
Ian, Paul Huttner here. Good to talk with you this morning. You know, you mentioned the economics of clean coal, of solar, of other sources of energy. What is your take on when solar sort of achieves price parity with coal? It's getting much closer, right?
It is getting much closer, and I don't study renewables as a market closely, so I don't have an exact answer. But everything I hear is that we're practically there, and so that's, like you say, I think one of the reasons why I think the battery issues, you know, kind of what do you do when the sun isn't shining, mm-hmm. is still the big challenge with renewables, and when the wind's not blowing for wind power. I think that my sense is that those challenges are still there to some degree, but there are even workarounds for that. But I think from a market perspective, renewables are really catching up. I think natural gas is the other sort of darling of the portfolio managers who have to decide in these states, you know, how they're going to get their power. Natural gas is kind of the other really attractive option that a lot of them are jumping to, and coal makes less and less sense. The only thing I would say, though, is if you look at this problem globally, you know, it is still a fact that, you know, 25-30% of the world's electricity comes from coal plants, and at the same time, 40% of the carbon emitted comes from coal plants. And so it's not as though we can unplug these plants tomorrow. There's a huge amount of electricity that comes from them. And so many folks argue that there needs to be some engineering solution figured out for what we're going to do about those plants and how we're going to bring those emissions down if we want to slow climate change.
This is one of the things, Paul, that we mentioned earlier about China that always surprises me, is I read about how forward-looking they are on their clean energy technology, but then again, how much demand there is for power in that country. And Ian, you may know about this, that even as they are addressing their pollution problem and their energy problem, they are still bringing online these coal plants because of the demand for electricity. So could a country like that benefit from this technology and do it in a way that this Mississippi plant couldn't?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I hear from, you know, kind of Wall Street analysts who watch the energy market is that partially because it's a command economy and a command, you know, sort of centralized government, they have the ability to push through projects that don't make economic sense in the short run. And therefore, you do see more progress on carbon capture there. They still haven't gotten it right. And in fact, this plant in Mississippi, one of its selling points, you know, as the company, you know, pitched it to investors and to regulators, was that if they could get it up and running, they could then sell that technology to China and India and Korea. And that would bring down the long-term costs that they had to front end to get it up and running. But again, you know, they haven't been able to do that, so it's not clear.
Ian, I think I read in your piece something like $6.7 billion is where we're at with cost with that plant. First of all, is that figure pretty accurate as far as you know?
It is, yeah. I mean, said to be the most expensive power plant in history, and it's accruing $20 to $25 million of extra debt every month that it's late, and they're still at least a couple months away. They're struggling to get the thing working. And the big thing that I worry about is even if they get it up and running next month, whether they can keep it online and whether it captures as much carbon as they promised and whether they have a place to sell that waste product, the carbon, those are the kind of boring, wonky, but really consequential questions that I hope that people keep asking when the gaze drifts away, mine included.
Ian Urbina is with us. He's a New York Times investigative reporter, and he wrote a piece that caught our eye about this clean coal project in Mississippi. It was headlined, "Piles of Dirty Secrets Behind a Model Clean Coal Project." And one of the points that I learned in the piece is that this was a very important coal, new technology, clean coal plant to the Obama administration's overall climate plan, which is why we're talking with Ian this morning on the ClimateCast. If you have a question, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 to Lionel in Woodbury. Hey, Lionel, hi. What do you want to know?
Say, I wonder if any of your guests have considered the issue of the gasification of biomass and coal rather than burning it to produce heat. By producing the gasification hydrocarbon chains, you get fuel, polymers, plastics, and byproduct heat for steam. The beauty of putting stuff into plastics is it's, in our sense, the ultimate sequester end place for carbon.
Okay, and let me see if we're a little bit beyond Ian's expertise there. Ian, what would you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I may be in deeper than I can go, but I will say that the challenge here is what do you do with the waste product? And often we fixate on carbon, right? You know, how do we pull the carbon out? And then what do we do with it? It's going to be very expensive if we get rid of it by injecting it in the ground. And and if we liquefy it and inject large quantities, then we have the Oklahoma earthquake concern, which is, you know, there's growing science that you inject this kind of waste liquids in the ground, you can trigger earthquakes.
As with the fracking in Oklahoma.
As with fracking, right. Exactly, and disposal wells. So it's costly and concerning. If you can sell the stuff, you know, they use it to stimulate oil wells, then that makes the cost more feasible. But the environmentalists quickly come back and say, well, wait a minute, so you're burning a fossil fuel, you're making it a little bit cleaner, but then you're taking the waste to increase the burning of another fossil fuel? How does that help the environment? And that seems a legitimate question to me.
Ian, I look forward to what you're going to write about this next. You're following the story, I assume.
I am, yeah.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the time today.
Thanks for having me.
Ian
Urbina is a New York Times investigative reporter, and Steph and I have tweeted out the article on this clean coal project. Paul, I know you're always watching a million other things when it comes to climate science. What's on your mind?
How about something very close to home that happened this week?
Okay.
Another extreme rainfall event for Minnesota. Hinckley picked up 9 inches of rain. That's about a one.
And what's the time period of that?
That was about 24 hours. It might have gone a little longer than that, but basically 9 inches of rain.
Unbelievable.
24 hours. There's a thing called Atlas 14 that NOAA has. It calculates the recurrence intervals of these extreme rainfall events. That's about a 1-in-800-year rainfall recurrence event. So you combine that with the 4 1,000-year floods we've had in Minnesota in the last 10 years, and now we're up to 5 nearly 1-in-1,000-year rainfall events.
And the connection with the climate science here, again, just to remind listeners, is the intensity of these events.
Right. So you add the atmosphere warms, you add more water vapor to the atmosphere, a warmer atmosphere does that, and then it delivers it more efficiently when we get these extreme rainfall events. People like Dr. Kevin Trenberth from National Center for Atmospheric Research that we've had on before says that climate change is adding maybe 5-10% rainfall to these extreme events.
Wow.
So there's a fingerprint there. And interesting to note, too, the St. Croix River at Grantsburg yesterday and last night set a new all-time flood of record in the past 24 hours, hit 15.4 feet versus 15.1, which was the record, and that body of water headed down to Stillwater, and they're concerned about flooding, having to change some events this weekend. One other quick thing, Carrie, we've set some interesting records this year. We're still on pace as the warmest year on record globally. 7 interesting climate records so far this year, warmest winter in the Arctic. Since October, every month has been the hottest on record globally. India, Alaska have all set records. Carbon dioxide levels, records over 400 parts per million. So they continue to add up. And if anybody hasn't seen it, there's a very interesting series on MSNBC in the last couple of weeks. Chris Hayes All In, Climate Change in the United States and the Effects. Remarkably well done. Worth a look if
I'm
you
so
haven't seen it.
I'm so glad you recommended that.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that. I have one question for you about our own forecast, because your voice about the glory index of last summer is always in my head. And then we get these forecasts where we had that hot spell just a couple days ago, and now I'm looking at the forecast, low 90s again. Is this just really typical, or are you seeing some trends here that we're also in this pattern of hotter weather this year?
Well, yes, we are. In fact, many of the months over the last year have been the warmest on record for Minnesota. So there was a 12-month period there as of a couple of months ago where this was the warmest 12 months ever on record for the state of Minnesota. Now, if you think it's been warm, wait till late next week and into the following week. Most of the models are saying we could have a prolonged, potentially extreme heat wave event headed for the Midwest and the upper Midwest starting late next week, maybe as early as Wednesday. Some of the models pushing it off a little later, but several days in the 90s. I could see 100 in the Twin Cities and well over 100 west and south, South Dakota, Iowa. This could be a very long duration heat wave. I think this will make national news.
And how unusual is that, Paul?
These don't happen every year, and we haven't had one the last couple of years. This could be the hottest stretch of weather since at least 2013 in Minnesota and maybe farther than that. We'll just have to see how this sets up. But all the models are saying this looks pretty intense. We could see a prolonged, intense, dangerous heat wave here in about a week.
Okay, we'll listen for you on Morning Edition and All Things Considered on that, and I hope I'll talk to you next Thursday.
Thanks, Carrie.
Thanks very much.